Picture a world where sentences never end, where thoughts blur into one another without warning, where you must decipher meaning from an unbroken stream of letters. This was the reality of early English writing. The Alfred Jewel, a stunning 9th century artifact housed in Oxford's Ashmolean Museum, bears an inscription that reads, "Aelfred Meechik Gewurkan." No spaces, no periods, no clues where one word ends and another begins. This wasn't carelessness. It was simply how people wrote. Reading was an oral performance, not a silent activity. When St. Augustine discovered his mentor St. Ambrose reading silently, he was so astonished he wrote about it in his Confessions, marveling at this strange sight of eyes moving across pages while lips remained still. The absence of punctuation made perfect sense when every text was meant to be spoken aloud. But as Christianity spread through England and silent reading became more common, something revolutionary happened. Spaces appeared between words. This simple innovation, the word space, became punctuation's first mark, transforming how humans processed written language and setting the stage for centuries of evolution in how we organize thought on the page. Reading scripture aloud in medieval churches carried eternal consequences. For illiterate congregations, hearing the Bible read correctly was their only access to divine truth. St. Benedict's rule was unforgiving. Make a mistake, and you'd prostrate yourself before everyone. Alcuin advised Charlemagne that scribes must use proper punctuation marks to prevent readers from stumbling mid-sentence. This pressure birthed systematic positurae, marks guiding pauses, voice modulation, and emotion. The punctus versus, resembling our semicolon, marked complete statements with falling intonation. The punctus elevatus, an inverted semicolon, signaled incomplete thoughts requiring rising tone. Most revolutionary was the question mark, helping readers lift their voices for interrogatives. Later came the punctus admirativus, ancestor of our exclamation point, for moments demanding emotional intensity. As manuscript production moved beyond monasteries, punctuation exploded. Pilcrows for paragraphs, parentheses for asides, forward slashes for brief pauses. Yet this innovation created lasting tension. Should punctuation guide speech and breath, or clarify grammar and logic? This fundamental question would shape debates for centuries. William Caxton printed the first English book around 1473, inheriting medieval chaos, periods and slashes used interchangeably, unpredictable spacing, inconsistent capitalization. The 16th century grew messier as writers attempted mechanical formulas. One period equals two colons equals four commas, producing artificial rhythms. Shakespeare's first folio shows compositors making different choices, sometimes improvising when running short on type. New marks like the exclamation point, called the Wonderer, gained popularity in the 1590s, yet usage remained wildly inconsistent. Printers gradually gained authority as uncertain authors deferred to printing house conventions. Two opposing types emerged: meticulous Johnsonians, like Ben Jonson, who fought printers over every mark, and Wordsworthians, like Wordsworth, who admitted being no adept and delegated corrections. Dryden called printers beasts and threatened eternal displeasure if they ignored his amendments. This battle between authorial vision and printing house standardization shaped our inherited conventions. By the late 16th century, punctuation entered grammar textbooks. Ben Jonson's English Grammar described punctuation marks as breathing pauses, and he famously quarreled with printers over his preferences. In Timber, he noted how writers fought as for their fires and their altars over punctuation details. The 17th century produced many guides, but zero consensus. Was punctuation for pronunciation or grammar? As grammar teaching became routine, the grammatical approach prevailed. Bishop Louth's influential 1762 grammar acknowledged that few precise rules can be given and much must be left to the judgment and taste of the writer. Joseph Robertson's 1785 essay listed 40 comma rules, yet admitted they couldn't cover every imaginable combination of words. Elocutionist Thomas Sheridan criticized this as erroneous, noting commas often appeared where speech required no pause. Despite criticism, the grammatical approach won, resulting in increasingly heavy punctuation throughout the 18th century. By the 19th century, printers like George Smallfield defined punctuation as the art of dividing a written composition into sentences. Punctuation forms a hierarchy of weight and meaning, starting with the blank page itself. Before any mark, we decide on titles, headings, footnotes, and body text, elements conveying importance and organization. Next come paragraphs. Traditional teaching emphasized unity with 3 to 6 sentences, yet modern writing shows single-sentence paragraphs can be powerful, while overly long ones hinder comprehension. At the sentence level, we have 6 main options for endings: period, neutral, question mark, questioning, exclamation point, emphasis, dash, abruptness, ellipsis, ambiguity, or nothing at all, open interpretation. Within sentences, commas determine meaning. Consider, my sister, who lives in China, has sent me a letter, one sister, versus my sister who lives in China has sent me a letter, multiple sisters. That single comma changes reality itself. Kurt Vonnegut dismissed semicolons as transvestite hermaphrodites representing absolutely nothing, yet used one in his final chapter, concluding, "Rules only take us so far." The semicolon expresses relationships between independent sentences that periods cannot, though usage has declined to just 2% of all punctuation. Apostrophes cause even more confusion. Jeff Deck and Benjamin Herson faced federal charges and $3,500 in fines for correcting a historical Grand Canyon sign. The apostrophe arrived late to English in the 16th century, partly explaining the chaos. Hyphens remain equally inconsistent. Compound words appear spaced, flower pot, hyphenated, flower pot, or solid, flower pot. The internet transformed everything. Digital communication brought both minimalism and maximalism. Users create strings like yes, etc., or novel sequences like dot, 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 while others eschew punctuation entirely. We now live in digraphia. Standard English punctuation dominates offline, while non-standard punctuation flourishes online. Periods in texting signal displeasure. We could do that reads neutral, while we could do that conveys annoyance. Multiple question marks indicate genuine curiosity, triple Q, while a single one can seem passive-aggressive. The most sensible approach to punctuation is pragmatic rather than dogmatic. Punctuation has always been subject to trends: formal versus informal writing, British versus American usage, print versus digital media. No one has ever defined rules explaining all uses of all punctuation marks. The best we can do is identify norms, plot trends, and emphasize personal consistency. Being pragmatic means respecting linguistic realities while not imposing unauthentic rules. Literary writers have long recognized punctuation's power. Jane Austen's manuscripts reveal her distinctive style featuring abundant dashes and minimal punctuation. But publishers normalized her writing, creating the false impression of Austen as prim rather than experimental. Emily Dickinson's poetry suffered similar interference, with her distinctive dashes replaced by conventional punctuation. Gertrude Stein despised question marks as positively revolting and unnecessary. A question is a question. Anybody can know that a question is a question, and so why add to it the question mark when it is already there? Punctuation's history carries one clear message. It exists to make written text clear. Punctuation is neither rigid rules nor personal free-for-all. It's a living, evolving set of conventions balancing clarity with expressiveness, tradition with innovation.